Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, the drummer for Lynyrd Skynyrd, Artemis Pyle, who survived the plane crash and escaped the wreckage and went for help. And what a story this guy tells. An incredible story. So really, you've all heard about the plane crash, but now you can get it from someone who was in the plane. So we'll get to that in a second. First, LifeLock. Hotels are advertising daytime reservations for people seeking quiet, distraction-free place to work. And hackers have figured this out, too. They exploit lax hotel Wi-Fi security to steal personal data. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk when we go on the internet and put the info out there. You can miss certain threats by just monitoring your credit alone. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock helps detect a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information, they will send you an alert. Protect yourself with LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all. This is LifeLock and see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
Well, finally, and all kudos to Mike Dawson for making this happen. Artemis Pyle is joining us, a legendary drummer from legendary band Lynyrd Skynyrd. Good to speak to you, Artemis.
It's good to speak to you, Adam.
The movie Street Survivors, the true story of the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash, and it's streaming now on demand, and you can go to Artemis's website, too, Artemis Pyle Band. .com. Congratulations on the movie.
Oh, man, thank you. You know, I'm a big fan of yours. I know you from TV and movies. I don't do any kind of social media. I've never touched a computer. I've never downloaded anything, sent or received an email. But, you know, from everything I hear, your podcast is amazing. As you well know, doing any kind of movie or video, it's hard just in its own way, you know, much less having a lawsuit on top of you the entire time. So enough credit cannot be given to Cleopatra Films for hanging in there with all the litigation. And eventually we prevailed.
Yeah, and prevailed. You did. The movie was great. It is a top shelf film. Very professional. Looks. I mean, the plane crash and all the stuff. It is amazing. And it's
man, that is so cool to hear from you because, you know, I value your opinion. And we had a small budget. You know. I know you speak the language, so we had $1,800,000.
That is a light budget.
Yes. It's a light budget, man. And the we couldn't get Nicole Kidman to play one of our backup singers or people like that. We had to use basically unknown actors and actresses. And these young people there in Los Angeles, they put their hearts and souls into these roles. They didn't care about lawsuits. And they were making a movie that could have been shelved in their lifetime. But, you know, we prevailed. But they put everything they had into the roles. I was so proud of all of them. I met their mothers and fathers at the red carpet we did there in Los Angeles at that free film festival down by Staples Center. That was on February 17th when we dropped it, you know. And then, of course, COVID hit the fan.
Right.
But that means so much to hear you say that.
Oh, it's great. That
the film, it told, I wanted to tell the story. And I thought that Cleopatra Films and our director, Jared Cohn, and as I say, everybody that worked on it, especially the actors and actresses, and the guy that played me, I mean, they worked him to death because all of that stuff, you know, was real. The coming out of the plane crash and when I first joined the band and my van broke down four blocks from Alex Cooley's on Peachtree in Atlanta, and I had to hand carry all my drums because I was not going to miss that audition. And you know, it was so it's accurate, but we wanted to make a film for the Skynyrd fans because, you know, I'm 72, and Skynyrd fans are not getting any younger. No one is, and so I wanted the story to be told so they'd know what happened that fateful day and that fateful night. So I compressed a whole story from my eyes, because if I went from anybody else's eyes, I'd get sued again. So I told it from my perspective and tried to do the best we could and keep it accurate. I spent 22 hours with Jared, the director, two 11-hour days, and I was crying and laughing and punching walls and screaming. I think I scared Jared a couple of times, but trying to get the story out.
Well, let's talk, Artemis, let's talk about the story. Let's talk about the crash, because that's what a lot of people remember. First off, I love Lynyrd Skynyrd. The reason I love Lynyrd Skynyrd is their variety of songs. People think it's one kind of rock, a southern rock, but if you take a listen to a song, like one of my favorite Lynyrd Skynyrd songs is You Got That Right.
Thank you.
I love You Got That Right. And if you listen to You Got That Right, we'll listen to 20 seconds of it. It's got a swing band to it. It's got a little funk and swing to it. And I love the piano. The piano. Here it comes. It's so layered compared to, you know, when you just go southern rock. But anyway.
So. Oh, man. I two things about, to your point. Number one, I love that song so much. I mean, you know, that's me on drums. And, of course, the great Bob Burns was the other drummer for Skynyrd. We were both inducted in the Hall of Fame together on the same night. And I love Bob so much. We lost him in a car wreck. But on that song, I love it because Ronnie and Steve, it's such a beautiful duet between the two of them. And they both knew their destinies. And they were telling us on that song what's going to happen. And I, you know, and the other thing you point out about Billy, you know, I'm almost about to cry. Billy Powell was one of the greatest keyboard players. He was a hammering, like a piano player, but he was trained classical. I've sat for hours and listened to Billy at his home back in the days play Mozart and just all kinds of classical. And it'll bring a tear to your eye. And you to point that out, the way he's hammering that that song. And I love playing that song. I do that with my band now, so thank you for that.
I love that song. And I love the fact that they have dual drummers, dual singers in that song. It's great. And it's a good – I won't say it's a good message, but it is the message of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Like, I like to drink and dance all night, comes to a fix, not afraid to fight. You got that right. And I love it when he goes, things I liked, I tried them twice. It's such
That's right. And you won't find me in no old folks home.
Right.
You know,
right.
They knew their destiny. I'm sorry if I confused the issue. Bob Burns, Robert Burns, that played on the first two albums of Skynyrd, and if it wasn't for Bob, you know, there might not have been a Lynyrd Skynyrd. They practiced in his carport down there on the west side of Florida. But Bob and I became very close friends. We talked every night, 4 o'clock in the morning. That's Lynyrd Skynyrd time, he called it. Mm-hmm. And he was killed in a car wreck, but that's only me on drums on You Got That Right.
Oh, not dual.
Bob actually, you know, and see, Ronnie wrote a song called Am I Losing? And that song was about Bob. Mm. And my thinking always was, when I was playing with the band after I filled in for Bob because he had some medical issues, and I always thought that Bob was going to come back to the band, because so many bands from the South had two drummers. Charlie Daniels' band had two drummers. later, the 38 Special Band had two drummers. That's Ronnie's little brother. Mm-hmm. And the Allman Brothers, of course, had two drummers. You know, Butch and J-Mo were good friends of mine. J-Mo is still a good friend of mine. So, you know, there was a lot of bands with the two-drummer thing, and I thought Bob was going to come back because Bob is so, he's got such a nice, and Al Cooper on the first two albums got such a warm and fuzzy sound for Bob. And when I came along, I played on Nothing Fancy. I didn't like my drum sound. I thought it was very thin against the tracks. And then later, Adam, when I heard those, I was going down the road one day, and they played our whole album that they had digitally remastered, and I had tears streaming out of my eyes because the drums and the tracks sounded the way they did when we recorded them. Hmm. But when they went to vinyl and you know, cassette, and back in the days, and 8-track, oh my God, 8-track, the drum sound came out very thin. And then they remastered our entire catalog, and it made everything sound great. But Bob Burns always had an incredible sound. And, you know, he was the original drummer for the band.
Right.
And I always used to introduce him as the Ringo Starr of Southern Rock.
Well, let's talk about the plane crash, because that's something that everyone is interested in, and including myself. And I didn't know all the details about it. But can you walk us through that day?
Well, I think about it every day. You were able to see the movie.
Yeah.
The plane that we used in the movie was the plane that we could afford.
Mm-hmm.
It was a C-117 tail dragger.
Mm-hmm.
The plane that we crashed, the tail set up in the air because it was tricycle landing gear, one on each wing and one on the nose.
Right.
It was a 560 Convair, but we couldn't afford, you had to get three planes, one in pieces, one for interior shots,
right,
and one for flight shots,
right,
and runway shots. So we couldn't afford all that. So we used the C-117, which I used to fly in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
And they have a very safe flying record, and they look cool.
Right.
They got two engines like the one that we crashed and everything, but we called them Goonie Birds. And the one that we used in the movie, you'll dig this, the one we used in the movie for the interior shots, and as you saw in the movie, there were a lot of interior shots,
mm-hmm,
it belonged to Cary Grant.
Wow.
He had it, you know, outfitted back in the days. In the, I guess, the 40s and 50s, he had it outfitted like a fancy tour bus or like a Learjet now.
Right.
And, you know, it was real nice. So the day that we crashed, which, you know, was just recently, October the 20th, 2020, was 43 years. And I always kind of go out in the woods, you know, and just kind of, I like being in the woods, you know.
So
when you called, I was doing my laundry and cleaning my kitchen, but normally I'm in the woods.
Well, let's not get into the weeds about the woods here. Let's talk about that day. I want to know,
I was in the woods.
Walk us through it. Yeah. Sorry.
And, we ran out of fuel on our way from Greenville, South Carolina to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We spiraled in from 9,000 feet. Our engines went out, and, you know, their engines don't run with no fuel.
Yeah, and, they just made a miscalculation on weight or fuel?
Well, I'm a pilot. My father was a pilot. My dad was killed in a plane crash. All my friends were killed in plane crashes, and I've been in three airplane crashes. So I'm qualified to tell the story. And what happened was we took on 400 gallons of fuel. You know that I went back and to Greenville, South Carolina, and did my own investigation. I wanted to know what the hell happened to my friends. So we took on 400 gallons of fuel in Greenville. But the pilot, as you saw in the movie, did not put a stick down in the tank and visually check it.
Mm-hmm.
So he was trusting the gauges on a 1947 Convair, you know, and the thing was old and had been, you know, flying for a long time. So those gauges were not, let's say, completely accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't top off the tanks. And we were 60 miles short of the runway in Baton Rouge. We were on a 95-city world tour going to Australia and back to Europe and Japan. But we had a bunch of shows that were going to use our plane in America. And, you know, the plane ran out of fuel. And we started going down. One engine went out. We'd been having trouble with it. I think that's one of the reasons, you know, it was using more fuel. Mm-hmm. It had, I think, like a problem with the engine where it was, we were flying like what they call crabbing. Mm-hmm. The engine was running lean and rich, and it was kind of surging. Mm-hmm. And it was causing us to crab in the air. So we knew, you know, there was some trouble. And our old pilot, whose name was Les Long, flew for Jerry Lee Lewis and Adam, right? You know, he's seen it all. He's seen everything. Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, did every crazy thing that there could be done.
On the ground, and I could only imagine what it was like in the air.
In the air, right?
Yeah.
So we had his plane, one that he had, which was a 560 Convair with Rolls-Royce engines, and it was a turboprop. So it was fast, and I flew both these planes.
Mm-hmm.
When the co-pilot would get up and walk away to go to the galley or the head, I'd fly it in there, and Les would look at me and make sure that I was, you know, not drunk or something,
right,
which I wasn't. Might have smoked a little weed, but I was not drunk, and he let me fly the plane. The one that we crashed was really, it was not a good airplane, man. It was red, white, and blue, and they painted our name on the side. So we were glad to have it, you know.
How long were you guys in the air before you ran out of fuel?
About 2 hours. And see, we had agreed to buy a Learjet for the band and two new tour buses for the road crew and the girls. We were going to get rid of that old plane. And then our flight time would be about, you know, we'd get a Learjet big enough for just the band. Mm-hmm. And we'd fly 45 minutes rather than 2.5 hours.
Right.
And that was the plan. And you know, that was what we were going to do. We weren't going to go with this old puddle jumper for long, but, you know, it didn't work out.
So the fuel runs out and you go, I think what they call it is dead stick, right?
Yeah, we were gliding. And,
yeah,
you know, they feathered both the props that, you know, turned the propeller blades into the wind so that it wouldn't, you know, drag, and our glide ratio would be more. But the pilots made several errors. Number one, they didn't put enough fuel on the plane. They didn't top off the tank. Number two, you know, they started to put the landing gear down at one point, which cut down our glide ratio.
Right.
And we were going to try to make it to a field beyond the trees that we crashed in, those Mississippi pine trees. And they tore us apart because we went down in that. And in the movie, that the new special effects and the CGI, as you see, it's very intense. It looks real. It's hard for me to watch.
Technically,
we ran out of fuel and they made some mistakes and we hit the trees instead of a
right.
Fuel.
So once you're out of fuel, you got to glide, and putting down the landing gear does not help you glide.
Yeah, it's, you know, the resistance, the wind resistance, just like feathering your props.
Were they thinking they could make it and kind of salvage the plane at that point?
Well, see, I was going back and forth because of my, you know, being a sergeant in the Marines, and I was going to fly jets for the Marines, and, you know, my dad and all the stuff with flight training. I was back and forth from the cockpit into the cabin, telling people to put out their damn cigarettes and, you know, to turn off any lights, conserve any energy that we had. I knew that was important. That's organic, you know. And so I was back and forth from the cockpit to the cabin, doing the stewardess thing. So at one point, I had strapped myself into the jump seat in the cockpit in between the co-pilot and pilot. And at one point, then the pilot turned around and looked at me, and he had a very glazed look in his eyes. I believe he was in the first stages of shock. And he told me, he said, "Artemis, you better go back and strap yourself in." And when he said that, I got up like a zombie. I didn't ask a single question. I got up, I folded the jump seat out of the way. I went back to the first seat that I got to, which was on the aisle over the left wing behind Cassie Gaines, mm-hmm. and next to a gentleman named Don Kretschmeyer that worked for Shoko. So that's where I was seated, you know, when we hit the trees.
How long from 9,000 feet with the engines going dead, how long is the gliding? How many minutes do you glide for?
Well, it was quite a few minutes. I mean, you know, we were above the clouds, and we had to go, you know, we were gliding, so we had no choice. We had to go into the clouds. So when you're into the clouds and you don't know where you are, and you don't know, you know, you've been spiraling, and I think they wasted some more of our glide ratio by kind of looking and turning back toward Macomb, Mississippi, and you know, they just utilized our energy that we had to maybe pull it off and hit a field and belly in and not be torn limb from limb, maybe be able to skid it in.
Right.
That's what you want to do. But they wasted a lot of our energy. So when we're in the clouds coming out of altitude, you know, on our, because we were at 9,000 feet when we started making our final approach. We were only 60 miles from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. That was where we were going to play that night.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we'd already started our descent. But things went, you know, they always tell you in an airplane crash, there's a series of things that go wrong. And we had, you know, everything in that series of things that could go wrong went wrong. And when we came out of the clouds, that was a sinking feeling because we were right on top of the trees. You know, there was no way to recover or gain altitude. I mean, when we were out of the clouds, we realized, and as a matter of fact, one of our road crew guys that was a road manager, really, he worked for Bill Graham.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for the great Bill Graham. And his name was Clayton Johnson. And I heard him say one word. He looked out the window and he said, trees.
Mm.
And he said it in a way that was like, you know, oh no, trees. So once we started, the trees were, the top of the pine trees were brushing against the belly of the plane. You know, you could hear it scratching. And then we got down into the meat of the trees. And then the trees were so big, it started just tearing us apart. I never lost consciousness. And I would say from the time that we started brushing against the top of the pine trees and got into the thick of it, it was probably 10 seconds of crashing, you know, mm-hmm. 10 or 11. And if you count that out, you know, 11 seconds, that's a long time when you're wrecking. You know, a lot of car wrecks are just like a big crunch, thump, bang, and it's done.
Right.
You know, this was a long series. And I watched the left wing come off. I knew we were in trouble, you know. I just held on for the ride. And then as in the movie, you know, everything just was silent. Momentarily before, you know, I could start hear people had been hurt, and they were like, you know, ouch.
What was, when you guys were gliding for that long period of time, what was the discussion, if any? Were people panicked? Were people saying goodbye? What was that period like?
Well, there was definitely people in prayer. I would say a lot of people were praying. I was very proud of the band for maintaining the way they did. But there was a couple of outbursts where one member of the band, Leon, got particularly mad when the co-pilot came back and, you know, said, we're going to try to make a field or a highway. And we're kind of thinking, well, neither one of those are really that good because we were right next to I-55.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, Leon like, he came up out of his seat, and I thought he was going to, like, you know, grab the co-pilot, you know, and there was going to be a brawl. You know, mm-hmm. their brawls were not uncommon mm-hmm. to the Lynyrd Skynyrd Band. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was going to be a brawl right there. But that was anger about, you know, the pilot and co-pilot. It became very obvious that they had made a series of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And Adam, you know, I've never hated these men. I've never held hatred in my heart for them. We lost everything that day. But their families lost their loved one as well. They screwed up, and they paid the price, because when I found them, you know, their bodies were torn completely apart. You know, one was decapitated, but it didn't bother me. It was just flesh and blood. I felt like, you know, this thing we call souls. You know, there is a soul, and I think we have souls, and I think there's something after this. I, you know, I'm not going to get into what I think, because my little human head would blow up. You know, I lived in Jerusalem, Israel, in the castle of King David on Mount Zion, and studied, you know, Torah. I'm a Gentile, and I studied Torah for like 3 years. So I feel like there's something beyond, but that's my own belief, and I don't discuss it. But I felt like there was no soul when I found the pilot and co-pilot. I didn't feel like it was an occupied space. Mm. It was just flesh and blood. And you know, that's what we're made of. And so we shouldn't be, you know, it should not be abhorrent to us if we look at flesh and blood. So, you know, I've never hated them for the mistakes that they made. I realized that they made a mistake that cost a lot of people and a lot of families.
Well, how many people?
And the music world, too. Oh, I mean, Ronnie ugh. Van Zant and Steve Gaines had kind of just gotten started.
How many, you know? How many souls were on the plane, and how many survived?
There was 26 people on board, including pilot and co-pilot, and 19 people plus me survived. Six people were killed basically on impact. And
was it all just luck of the draw, just where you were particularly seating or being seated?
Well, you know, the back of the plane is better. That's why in the movie, you noticed at one point, I mean, the movie's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make up a bunch of shit, you know. The movie is accurate. So when Ronnie was walking from the front of the plane, see, I saw him pass me after I'd gotten on the aisle. And I saw Ronnie go by me toward the back of the plane. And I thought to myself, good idea. You know, it's better in the back of the plane, you know, and you might survive. And then here comes Ronnie again, right beside me. He stopped next to me. We did the old hippie handshake. There were no words, but he had a crimson velvet pillow in his hand, and he walked back toward the front of the plane, and then I thought, bad idea. So, you know, being in the front of the plane was not a good place. Dean Kilpatrick was killed up there. Of course, the pilot and co-pilot, Ronnie, Steve Gaines, they were all sitting up front. Alan was hurt really bad. He was up front. Gary was hurt really bad. He was up front, you know. And so it was, I would say the back, you know, was the place. And I thought it was great that Ronnie was going back there. And then he walked back forward. And I'll never forget, you know, he told me in Tokyo, Japan, that he would never live to see 30 and that he would go out with his boots on, which, as you know, with his boots on as a cavalry, you want to die in the saddle. And to a musician, that's on the road. And Ronnie knew his destiny. He was 29 years old. He was killed. And when he stopped and shook my hand, there was a smile on his face. I mean, wow. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And Ronnie had a beautiful smile when he wasn't mad at somebody and beating the crap out of somebody, man, you know, or mad at a promoter or mad at a manager or something and drinking too much scotch. He was a gentleman, and he was a gentle person, and I love being around him. I roomed with him all over the world. But, you know, when the doctor told me that Ronnie had not made it, it was not a surprise to me.
So the crash happens. You come up. You assess. You're injured as well. What are your injuries?
Well, you know, when a doctor does heart surgery, mm-hmm. and they're called chest crumpers, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, rib spreaders or whatever.
So right. that's all the cartilage down the middle of your rib cage.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the doctors do when they do heart surgery. They make an incision all the way down, and they cut that cartilage, and then they use a retractor to hold your rib cage open mm-hmm. so they can get in and work on your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did in the plane crash was I ripped by the impact. I ripped all of my cartilage rather than it being cut with a scalpel. It was like just ripped.
Mm-hmm.
And so my chest was, I felt like I was going to die. I mean, my life didn't flash before my eyes or anything like that. I've been close to death many times, and I've never gotten that feeling. It didn't happen in the crash itself, but once I realized that I was injured, I just kind of had to hold myself with my arms. I had to kind of hold myself together, and it was not easy to walk. It was painful, and in the crash, because of the the forward motion suddenly stopping in those 10 to 11 seconds, my boots came off. They just kind of came off my feet. And my socks were kind of 6 inches over the edge of my toes. And it was hard walking in the swamp with the briars and the brambles. And I eventually just pulled the socks off.
What time was it?
It was about sunset, about around 6:30. I think the official time was 6:48.
Mm-hmm.
It was October. It was Mississippi. It was starting to get a little chilly in the evenings.
So you're up and you got to go try to find help, or people don't know, was there any radio communication that you guys were going down or what your location might be when you went down?
Well, the pilot and co-pilot were really busy, and I sat in the little jump seat, and I made a mayday call to a Coast Guard chopper that was in the area. And I called off our tail numbers, NV-55, and I was saying, it was basically a mayday, we're out of fuel, going down. And then when I was walking out and it was getting kind of dark underneath the canopy of the trees that I was in the little black water area that I thought was a swamp, and it was a creek that had gone out of its, it was like high water.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an actual Coast Guard chopper that must have heard the mayday that I put in was over top of me. But because there was no fuel, there was no fire, and because we were below the canopy of the trees, they couldn't see, and it was getting dark, and they really couldn't see properly, so they were missing us.
Wow.
And so it was ironic, and it was very hard to hear this chopper flying over and then away, in the wrong direction, away from my friends. Cause that was my whole thing, which I did. I went and got help and brought it back to the crash site. That's what a Marine does, and I was using everything that I'd learned, my Marine Corps training, to put one foot in front of the other and just, not go into complete shock, which I was. I mean, I was going into shock.
How far away was the farmhouse from the wreckage?
I'd say a mile, something like that. It seemed I had to go across a freshly plowed field,
mm-hmm.
Which is hard to walk if you're not hurt. And my legs, of course, from pushing through the metal to get out of the fuselage, the ripped, torn fuselage, to get out of my seat, I had to push through that and drop to the ground. There was a little space,
mm-hmm.
and I pushed my way out, and I cut my legs up really bad. And so I was dealing with that. And but you know, nothing was going to stop me, man. That scene where the snake came up and I told the snake that I would bite its effing head off, that really happened. And it was a really strange moment, Adam, because I'm in this black water and the snake is slithering by, and I said to it, I will bite your effing head off. And I heard myself say that, and I laughed at myself for saying, talking right to a snake. And when I laughed at myself, I realized I was alive.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
And, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I could see, because I maybe you're in shock, or maybe it's a dream, or maybe you're in heaven, or maybe you're in hell, but laughing would kind of wake you up and alert you to the fact that you were alive. That this wasn't.
It did. And the snake went away. I didn't have a conversation with the snake or anything. I just said, I will bite your fucking head off. Excuse me. Your effing head off.
And, sorry.
The Marine Corps came out of me there.
So you get to the farmhouse, and it's about a mile away. And the guy doesn't know who you are, and you look a little dicey because of what you've been through, right?
Well, I look more than that. I look like Charles Manson. I mean, my hair was down to my waist, my beard was down to my belly button. I look like, you know, like caveman from hell, and I've got blood on me,
right?
You know, and I'm just dragging myself along. He had a gun. He pointed at me. He fired. I felt something sting me in my left shoulder. He says it was a ricochet. I don't give a damn what it was. I was in shock from the plane crash. And then I felt this sting and heard the gunshot. You know, Jake Tapper from CNN is a friend of mine, and he was working for VH1 at the time. And Jake asked the guy, he said, did you have a gun? And he goes, yeah. And he said, did you point it at Artemis? He goes, yeah. And he said, did you pull the trigger? He said, yes, I did. And he said, well, how can you say that you didn't really shoot him? And he said, oh, it must have been a ricochet. And, you know, my answer to that is I don't care what it was. I as a Marine, I was taught to hit the ground when you heard a shot like that to make a smaller target.
Right.
So I instinctively dropped to the ground because the getting hit in the left shoulder, it kind of spun me anyway.
Right.
And when I went down, I thought maybe my last breath. And I yelled, plane crash. And Johnny, the farmer, Johnny Moat, Johnny said, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And he came over and he picked me up and he helped me to his house. And I made a phone call to my wife and told her, we've had a plane crash, honey. I just saw her 2 hours before. And I said, honey, we've had a plane crash. You're going to see it on TV. You're going to hear it on the radio. I'm alive. I got to go. It was less than 30 seconds.
Jesus.
And I went back out, and Johnny put me in, you know, his pickup truck, and I just pointed, and he drove through fences and through ditches and up banks, and and then behind us was a whole bunch of rescue vehicles, sheriffs, state troopers, you know, ambulances, because a week before we crashed there, they had a civil defense drill. And when they heard us crash, the whole county thought it was a train wreck. They thought a train had derailed.
Mm-hmm.
So they had already started, you know, like gearing up to come out for some kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the people from Johnny Moat's home had, you know, called and said, you know, we got Charles Manson walking up on the house here. Better send the police. And so... You know, when we came out of his driveway and started going through fences and up banks and through ditches, they all followed us. And so behind me was a whole parade of help for my friends, because I knew that every drop of blood was a second closer to death for my friends, and every second, you know, was a problem. So we got to where I came out of the woods, and, you know, where I had to roll over barbed wire. I had puncture wounds all over. I had no leverage to jump up and down right over this barbed wire fence. I had to literally lay on it and roll over it, which was not fun. And on the other side of the fence were like 20 cows. And I'll tell you right now, I would have kissed every one of those cows on the lips. They look so good to me because I know if, you know, I was raised on farms and my grandfather raised cattle and horses. And, you know, when I saw those cattle, I knew that there were people somewhere.
Did you know?
And that gave me hope.
Did you know who had survived and who hadn't on the plane before you left? You knew the pilots were gone.
I found them and they were gone.
What about Van Zandt?
I knew that Ronnie was gone because he had told me. I just had that feeling. And it's just, you know, something when the doctor told me, he said that Ronnie had been killed by a single blow to the head. And what that was we had been flying with a Sony Trinitron TV and one of those great big Sony machines and a Betamax. Because remember when it was both?
Sure, yeah.
You know, and we had Betamax and we had real high sophisticated games on board, like Pong.
Right. Like Pong is like the first video game ever.
And we had it on our plane, man. It was like it's stupidest. Anyway.
Yes. It's basically air hockey for people that are super stoned.
Yeah. And we thought we were something else, you know, and having that on board the plane.
Well, so that's what got
it
him.
It killed Ronnie. That stuff came forward, you know, centrifugal force, right?
Sure.
And we, you know, the immovable object was hit by the unstoppable force. And all of that stuff came forward, and the doctors told me that Ronnie was intact. He was you know, looked like Ronnie, but that he had sustained a tremendous blow to the head, you know, and did not survive it. He said it was instantaneous.
How many open seats were there in the back of the plane, and how come we know Ronnie's story, Ronnie's destiny, but didn't everyone just want to move to the back of the plane? It's clearly safer, obviously, in an accident like this.
Yeah, and I don't think the people that were up front were really thinking that we were going to go into Mississippi pine trees. Everybody up there, everybody on the plane and in their seat, you know, because I'd gone back through and told everybody, you know, buckle up, pull them tighter, get a pillow, put something in your, you know, put out the cigarettes. I was playing stewardess. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that everybody, I'm sure, in their minds had some hope of, you know, putting the landing gear down and landing safely on something.
Right.
Or at the very worst, bellying the plane in and
right.
skidding through the dirt for a minute, which that plowed field that I walked through, I got to tell you, it would have been like, you know, you're up in the mountains and you see those runaway truck stop things,
right?
Where they make them in furrows.
Yeah, the sand traps, right?
The sand traps and the furrows, right? And that would have worked really good if we would have bellied into that plane, into that field. And that's what we were headed for, but we just didn't make it. And, you know, a lot of people thought that by putting the landing gear down, that, which I feel too, that it tripped us into the woods sooner than we had to. We could have bellied, you know, we could have brushed through perhaps.
Yeah.
But that the, you know, one landing gear or two, they tried to bring him back up, but our hydraulic power was not under power from the engine, so they couldn't get the landing gear back up. So
yeah.
It was a mess.
I mean, for people that don't know, a plane can glide in and at the very last minute do a move called a flare, where you just lift it. You just lift that nose right at the end of that glide slope, and you could belly
exactly.
in. And you know, a lot of people have survived a lot of plane crashes by doing that flare move. But obviously,
Sully Sullenberger,
Sully Sullenberger,
miracle on the Hudson, man.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what he did. And another thing, I used to fly hang gliders, 18-foot Regala wings. I bought one in San Diego, and took it home, and you know, flew that thing. And that's what you do when you're coming in for a landing. You flare your nose up, and you land like a bird. Now, in an airplane, it's not, you're not going to land like a bird, but you're going to get that skidding motion going. You're not going to nose in. And that's exactly right, Adam, the flare move, but we didn't get a chance to use it.
We got to take a quick break. Dawson's got a whole bunch of really interesting questions for you, Artemis, because
Michael?
Michael Dawson. He's very, very deep into this subject. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Artemis and Dawson right after this. Artemis Pyle is with us. Street Survivors, the true story of the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash. Very good movie, as you can hear just how intense that crash was. But there's so much more to the movie than the crash, and it's streaming now on demand. Michael Dawson, has a question. So take it away, Dawson.
Yeah, Artemis, thanks again for doing this interview. It's just it's fascinating, and you've brought me to almost to tears a few times during this, so forgive me if it gets a little misty in here. But let's get to
it's Veterans Day, man. It's Veterans Day. So, okay. And yesterday was the 245th birthday of the United States Marine Corps. Happy birthday, hoorah, semper fi! And so today, tears are allowed.
So. I know that the Sweet Home Alabama Skynyrd was before you joined the band, but I'm especially curious about the relationship between you guys and Neil Young. I mean, when Neil Young did Southern Man and Alabama, if he played a show in the South, he'd get death threats. But I don't know if it's I don't know if it's true. But the legend is, the rumor, that Neil Young was an honorary pallbearer at Ronnie's funeral. Is that true?
Okay, I'm going to answer that. I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't there because he was recuperating and recovering, and I wasn't there. So that could be true, but I know one thing to be true. Ronnie Van Zant loved Neil Young. And Neil and Ronnie had written music. They were going to write the answer to Southern Man.
It was Powderfinger.
Home Alabama.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, Matt, just ponder on that for a second. What would be the song that Neil and Ronnie would write to answer Southern Man, Bullwhips Crackin', and Sweet Home Alabama? It would have been amazing, but of course Ronnie was killed. I talked to Neil about this at one point with Leon Wilkeson, the bass player for Skynyrd. Of course, we lost Leon years ago. There's only Gary Rossington and myself left, but I can assure you that Ronnie respected and loved Neil Young. I can say this, that on the Street Survivors album, Ronnie's wearing a really cool jacket, and underneath the jacket is a Neil Young T-shirt. So, you know, why would Ronnie wear a Neil Young T-shirt?
Right.
It's just like people thinking that Ronnie was, you know, because of the Confederate flag, that he was racist, and he was not at all. He loved, if people were good people, he, you know, That's all you had to be, was a good person.
Absolutely.
Nothing else mattered. And that's the way I feel. And so, you know, he and Neil Young, I'm sure, would have collaborated on all kinds of stuff. It's boggles the mind to think about. But, you know, there's a lot of myths that are out there. And, you know, I'd kind of like to think that he was a pallbearer.
Okay. Now, Neil wrote the song Powderfinger. Was that written for Skinner to perform?
I know that there was a submission of songs from Neil. And, of course, I'm sure going, you know, to Ronnie first. It's not going to go to the drummer first. I'll tell you that right now.
Right.
But I'm sure I know that there was a submission of tunes that Neil was working on that Ronnie was looking at. So I don't know if that was one of them.
Okay. Now, after the plane crash, the first effort at resurrection for members of the band, Gary and Alan did the Washington Collins band. And it's said that you didn't join the band because you were in a motorcycle accident, but I kind of get the feeling that if you wanted to join the band, they would have made it doable for you. What were your feelings on that project? Did you have any interest in joining that effort?
Oh, we had already started moving forward, you know, and writing some material with a guy named Barry Lee Harwood, who was a friend of the band. He played on one of the Skinner albums, Nothing Fancy. And Barry Lee was a great songwriter, and he was already working with Gary and Alan. I bought a Harley Davidson, and I was coming home one night, and a truck pulled out in front of me and broke my right leg in 21 places.
Wow.
So I'm stainless steel from my knee to my ankle in my right leg. And I lost, you know, about 1¾ inches out of the length of my right leg. So I have a buildup I can only wear boots, and I have a buildup so that I can walk straight and keep my back. And I'm a performer. I don't like to limp around on stage. So, you know, that is so true. And I named that band. I named the band Washington Collins because I told Gary and Alan, I said, man, you know, that's who this band is now. You guys are original members, and it kind of flows, Washington Collins. It kind of automatopoeia. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, you know, so I named the band. And then that happened. And, you know, I told Alan and the guys in the band, there was a great drummer, that from Jacksonville, Florida, that you know, that they were friends with. His name was Derek, and really cool guy. So he came in and played with the band, and you know, I knew that I wasn't going to be able to walk for at least 2 years.
Okay.
Even then, so I it was a hard decision, but I told the guys, I said, "Man, you," and they were using me as an excuse for not going back into the public. They were still healing up from the airplane crash, where I healed up much quicker, you know, than anybody in the band. And so, you know, I was already playing and everything and going forward, and they were still kind of healing, using me as an excuse after I broke my leg. And I said, man, you got to get another drummer. And Derek Hess, really fine drummer. And he played on those. Don't misunderstand me. That was a Barry Lee Harwood song that he sang a duet with Gary's wife Dale.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Yeah, I would have been in that band, and we would have continued to try to go forward. But you know, another thing that really took its toll, and I'll just be very honest, it was cocaine. The band, everybody in the band, had a tremendous cocaine problem, and I had a problem with that. I know what cocaine is. I've done cocaine. I don't like cocaine. I'm a pothead. You know, I smoke weed, and that was my a little vice, but coke is a whole different scene. It's just sinister, and it makes people do stupid stuff. And so that was very prominent at that time because there was money, you know.
Right.
We were at the top of our game when the plane crash happened, so there was all this money and cars and new houses and partying and champagne and cocaine. And that back in those days, guys, think about it. There wasn't grief counseling, you know. And the grief counseling for Lynyrd Skynyrd ended up being drugs and alcohol. So it was unfortunate.
Have you ever considered the irony of the Lynyrd Skynyrd live album title, One More from the Road?
Yeah, I've thought about it. You know, I think about the plane crash every day. It's part of my existence because of what happened to my father and the fact that I was in three airplane crashes. It's just part of my life. I'm not being morbid, but there's a lot of ironic scenarios surrounded that I've lived, you know, since that day, October 20th, 1977. And it's just... some of them are easier to live with than others, but man, you know, what the stuff that I've been through is nothing to things that people all over this planet go through every day and are going through right now. You know, I've got nothing to complain about. I was in the greatest Southern rock band of all time.
God,
you know,
right.
I got inducted in the freaking Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's something I never even thought about, being in the Hall of Fame. You know, I didn't walk around going, I'm going to do this. But because of Ronnie Van Zant and Charlie Daniels, those two guys believed in me, I found myself being inducted into a pretty small club.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a jazz freak. So we were inducted with Miles Davis, and I got to hang out all night with Herbie Hancock. So how about that?
All right, Artemis, I got one more question for you, and I'm going to press you to an answer here.
Okay.
What is your favorite Lynyrd Skynyrd song?
It would be Saturday Night Special.
Nice. Mm. Why?
Well, that song was used in that Burt Reynolds movie when Burt was being chased the longest yard. And when Bert was being chased by the police, that was filmed in Savannah, and then he dumped the Citroen Maserati into the Savannah River, which used to catch fire until Ralph Nader, you know, made people put it out. But that song, it's such a favorite song for me because I worked with Al Kooper,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of things that a lot of people think that ba-dump, pow, ba bum bum bum. That was not my idea. That was Al Kooper's. He came out to me and he says, man, Artemis, can you play this lick like this? Can you execute this? And he told me the drop lick, and I did it. And it's kind of a really, it adds a real cool flavor to the verse. And then, you know, the beginning of Saturday Night Special, I'm banging on the snare drum. It's, you know, ba da da bam bam ba da. It's real powerful.
Well, here,
almost heavy metal. And Adam,
yeah.
You said something a while ago.
Mm.
You said about the that every song is different with Skynyrd.
Yeah.
And man, I'm the drummer of Lynyrd Skynyrd, and you are so correct. No two Lynyrd Skynyrd songs are the same. Every song has got a little different nuance, little stop, starts, dynamics,
completely.
You know, fast, slow. Every one of them, there's no song, you know, any two the same. And I love that about being the drummer of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I get to play these songs. One of my favorite pieces that I like to play by Bob Burns, one of his drum tracks, what is I Ain't the One.
Mm-hmm.
I love playing that, especially in front of other drummers, because it's such a piece, and the timing and the punches and everything. And, you know, I'm 72 and I'm in five bands with my sons and my band. And, you know, I still play, you know, this music like I'm 30. And you know, I'm actually enjoying playing now more than ever. But
one of the
since you pressed me for one Saturday Night Special, for sure.
Another thing that I love about Lynyrd Skynyrd, especially being a comedian, is they had a great sense of humor. You know, give me three steps. You know, you listen to the story play out, the breeze, call me the breeze.
Yeah.
You know, like you listen to the songs unfold and you realize like a lot of bands, especially Southern rock, you know, they think they have to have a lot of bravado and kind of get up there and do a lot of kick this guy's ass and made love to his woman. But if you listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd songs, they were the ones who were running from the jealous husband. They were the ones who didn't get laid. Like it's a self-deprecation that bands aren't secure enough to have.
Yeah.
Most bands need that. Where did that come from? Well, especially in Southern rock. It's not a Southern rock thing.
That was Ronnie's prolific songwriting, man. Look at Simple Man,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about his mother, saying, you know, get a good woman, be a simple man, keep it simple. I mean, we just opened up before COVID hit. We opened up at Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee, Grand Ole Opry, for Dolly Parton. And we were raising money for cancer. And we did Simple Man, Sweet Home Alabama, and Freebird, and literally took the roof off the Ryman Auditorium. And I looked over and Dolly was smiling. I mean, I was never so proud. I think she's number one in the whole world as far as a human being. She's a humanitarian. So I watch what you guys are talking about. I watch this happen all the time with the music. And, you know, when we used to, last year, when we met with people after the show and did our meet and greets, every song, you know, Ronnie did not write just hit songs. He wrote hit albums. So every single song has something special to the individual listeners, and a lot of veterans, and of course bikers, you know, bikers love the music. But you know, I play for veterans all the time because I am a veteran. You know, Marine Corps 67 to 71 sergeant. I recently was promoted to colonel. I am a Kentucky colonel because I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and they just made me a Kentucky colonel. So that's news. Would you guys mind if I did one little plug?
No, go ahead.
The soundtrack, guys, to the movie. I was unable to use any Skynyrd music, and I was happy not to, because I knew that Judy Van Zandt, Ronnie's widow, would come with a bunch of blood-sucking weasel $1,000-an-hour attorneys, you know, and try to stop, just like they did stop the music, stop the movie. So I decided to go ahead and write an all-new score soundtrack to the movie. I said, let's just do it ourselves. And in my opinion, you know, it's Grammy award-winning. We will probably get passed over for our category of something that really happened in history and an original sound score because of COVID. You know, I'm not whining, but I think it's really good. My sons that lived this life with me, my oldest son, Chris, he wrote four songs for the movie soundtrack that are unbelievable. My son, Marshall, my middle son, he wrote a song for the right when we're pulling up to the plane for the last time. And the limousines, and I'm in a Jeep with my wife, and we're getting on the plane for the last flight. He wrote a song, and the hook is basically, live each day like it could be the last day of your life. So my sons and my band, my incredible band out of Asheville, North Carolina, they wrote with Warren Haynes. You guys know who Warren Haynes?
Yeah, from Government
Mule. They wrote that Street Survivor soundtrack song with Warren, and it came out incredible. I think it's a bona fide Southern rock hit. So I just want to say that I think our soundtrack is worth listening to all the way through. It's got some rockin' tunes on it, some beautiful stuff. The score itself, which is like the kind of Game of Thrones background music, was done by Christopher Rittenauer, and he did an incredible job out there in Los Angeles. And a friend of mine from, it was very important for me to get this song in the movie, and it's an instrumental. And the reason is because Ed King actually co-wrote the song, and Ed, as you know, wasn't on the airplane when we crashed.
Right.
So I wanted to get Ed involved in the movie, so there's an actor playing him, and he gets credit for a song on the soundtrack. So, you know, check out the soundtrack sometime, guys. There's some pieces on there that I commissioned that were like instrumental.
A lot of great
that are powerful, yeah, yes, powerful stuff.
It
so
really does
you.
Set the tone for the movie. I mean, it's there's some swampy, there's some dark stuff. It's all in, and it's about half and half. Would you say the half lyrical songs and then about half just instrumental score?
That's exactly right. Two pieces that I commissioned, and then the score itself that was on there, and a song, a bonus track called Kentucky Brother that's on there, and I was born in Kentucky. So, you know, the the whole effort. Everybody worked hard and could have given up. Cleopatra could have, thrown in the towel at any time on this because of the constant lawsuit, but you know, we went to the Court of Appeals a few years ago. We had this thing called a constitution, and that requires three judges in the Court of Appeals, and they all unanimously gave us the thumbs up to finish the movie, because Judy Van Zandt basically said, Artemis, you're not allowed to tell your story.
Well,
it's
been beautifully told. And by the way, the soundtrack you can get on Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get music. Street Survivors, the true story of the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash. It's streaming now on demand. Artemis, this has been a surreal and endlessly fascinating conversation. I hope you can come back sometime and tell us even more.
Listen, you got my number. You know, call me anytime, because we're trying to ring out this movie, and we're trying to ring out our soundtrack and everything under the pandemic, like everybody else in the world is having to deal with. And it's difficult enough to do the movie besides the pandemic. So I appreciate you guys and Adam sincerely. You know, I am a fan, and I appreciate you guys helping me get the word out about our little movie and our soundtrack. You realize that we used one song that a lot of people think is Lynyrd Skynyrd, which is Call Me the Breeze.
J.J. Cale.
It's not a Lynyrd Skynyrd song.
That's a J.J. Cale song.
It's J.J. Cale, and that's the reason that we were able to do just like anybody else and pay for the licensing and use it in the movie. And we used it in the movie for a live shot. For the movie, I had to compress it. I had to show me getting the gig with the band, that experience, us, you know, rehearsing, and then a live gig, which is where we used Call Me the Breeze, and then what happens after the gig at the venue, what happens at the hotel later, and then the story has to start building toward, you know, the crash. And everybody did an amazing job, and I appreciate you guys helping me get the word out, man.
Thanks, Artemis. We'll speak soon.
Thanks, Artemis. You. God bless you, man.
All right, man. All right. I didn't want to do any spots while I was talking to Artemis because it's too interesting. So I'll give you the last couple. Liquid IV. Oh, man, I've been all up in this Liquid IV lately. I have a thing where I get sometimes I get night sweats, and I've had it for the past few days where I just wake up and the sheets are soaking wet. And I got up in the middle of the night, and I just made myself up a big old liquid IV glass and chugged it all down before I went back to bed. Especially flu season's around the corner, and you got to stay hydrated, people. It's a hydration multiplier. And also supports your immune system as well. Cutting edge blend of vitamin C, vitamin D, and well-immune and naturally sourced beta-glucan. Proven to help strengthen your immune system. Get a few packs of this stuff and just bring it with you when you're on the road or whatever. I always keep this stuff with me. It's Liquid IV, right, Dawson?
Liquid IV's new hydration multiplier plus immune support is available at Walmart, or order online and get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code Adam at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you use promo code Adam at liquidiv.com. Get better hydration today at liquidiv.com, promo code Adam.
And last but not least, Simply Safe. Break-ins on the rise during the holidays. Simply Safe's having a huge holiday sale. 30% off any system and a free security camera as well. Whether you're traveling or staying put for the holidays, check out the 30% off plus security camera deal. It ends this week. We use Simply Safe here. I've used Simply Safe since they came on as a sponsor. It's a great product. It's a great company. Peel and stick, up and running. Batteries last up to 10 years. U.S. News and World Report says best home security of 2020. CNET gives it editor's choice. An arsenal of sensors and cameras. Set up yourself in about 30 minutes and you're off and running. It is Simply Safe, right, Dawson?
Get 30% off Simply Safe plus a free security camera today by visiting simplysafe.com/Adam. Go today. This deal is this week only. That's simplysafe.com/Adam. Simplysafe.com/Adam.
All right. A very interesting show. I thank Ami Horowitz for jumping in, and Artemis Pyle, of course, and also West Palm Beach, Florida, coming up improv. Couple of shows there November 20th and 21st. Just go to adamcarolla.com. I'm playing live shows all over the place now, so just go look me up. I'm coming to your town. Check out our YouTube page, youtube.com/Adam Carolla. Until next time, this is Adam for Ami and Artemis and Gene and Bald saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. Get the links at adamcarolla.com and watch Street Survivors. Buy the soundtrack. Thanks, Artemis.
Support for this podcast comes from Pluto TV. Ready to get away from it all? Free yourself with Pluto TV. Stream hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and shows all for free. Yeah, free. No contracts, no subscriptions, no fees. Imagine 24/7 channels of Narcos, CSI, Star Trek, Survivor, and everything else from hit movies to binge-worthy TV shows, the latest news, live sports, comedy, and more. What are you waiting for? Download the free Pluto TV app for Android or iPhone and start watching now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.